Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Well, folks, welcome back. And we have Tammy Young back with us. Welcome back, Tammy.
Hello. Thank you.
And so the last thing you and I covered, you know, and there's all sorts of things going on in the news, and most people think that we would be talking about that type of stuff. This content is far more important. We're running out of time for what people really need to understand, what happened, why it happened, because every single one of these cases, I am providing you empirical data of why the ratification debates were so critical. Because as it came up, when the Constitution was being violated, Madison pointed to them. When they started creating this bank, how that was so unconstitutional, Madison pointed to the ratification debates. So putting aside that it's only going to get worse, more kids are going to die. People are dying daily because they're waging warfare against us, whether it be cultural, whether it be chemical. In every way they possibly can, their outcome is ultimately purging the earth. And so, yeah, and, you know, it's just a sign of the times because the Bible tells us about these things. But instead of, you know, talking about things you should be talking on Sunday at church and Sunday school, let's talk about what we need to understand regarding the magnitude of this problem and the simplicity of following the Constitution. So, what we're going to be covering today is the Whiskey Rebellion. And there's a lot of detail in this. And so what I've done is I've kind of gathered a lot of different accounting as to what happened. And so what we have is this document, and we'll share this. But this document basically kind of accounts for how this all happened. Now, remember that the whiskey tax, if I remember correctly, it started in 1792. And they needed to have a way of starting to make money to pay for this debt that they assumed, right? And so as we look at this this application, let's just say it that way, the application of the whiskey tax, that kind of became one of these things that was really hated. And Tammy, you mentioned earlier, before we started, that why this whiskey tax? Because it's, you know, it was, how is that uniform? And back in those days, almost everybody drank whiskey or distilled liquor. And so the distilleries were having to pay this excise tax. It wasn't just on whiskey, but they called it a whiskey tax because that was the predominant distilled liquor at the time. Good old American whiskey. And as we talked about, they had refrigeration problems and so forth. So that was the one nutrient that could be preserved in quantity to, you know, supply them with some basic, you know, shots through the winter. Anyway, and so that's one of the reasons why drunken disorderly was pretty common in the wintertime, too, because the abundance of fresh food was really going out the window, and people that couldn't, you know, store food or what have you, they lived more on, you know, either the, you know, a little bit of bread and whiskey or what have you. And so when we look at this tax and why it ended up basically ending. In other words, they stopped this excise tax on whiskey shortly after or while Jefferson was president. And the reason why was because it was really an unsavorable tax. I mean, it's taxing a necessity. In their mind, it was taxing the necessity. And they felt like the government was attacking them to survive. And so it would be like taxing milk today. And so... Yeah. So it was not really well received, but bottom line, it was something that the federal government had the authority to do. They flexed their muscle and they did it. So in the onset, there were challenges to this, and there were states that said, hey, you know, can you do this? And as the state attorney generals or whomever the leadership of the state, in talking to the federal government, they basically, yeah, this, you know, you really don't want to go to court over this because you'll lose. We have the authority to establish excise taxes. So, all right, they didn't like it, but they said, okay, we'll support it. And so all the states started supporting it, except for a one, and that was the western area, or I should say the far western area of Pennsylvania. And technically, this area was really in the Ohio Valley, out that way. So, because they go, I think they end up going out to Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh is on the, I believe, the west side of Pennsylvania. Anyway, so I'll let you go ahead and kind of read through this. This is kind of more of a packaged story as it goes. And so as you have hit something or as you have questions, let me know, and there'll be some highlight parts that, you know, we'll want to kind of talk about. But go ahead.
Okay. The Whiskey Rebellion was a 1794 uprising of farmers and distillers in western Pennsylvania in protest of a whiskey tax enacted by the federal government. Following years of aggression with tax collectors, the region finally exploded in a confrontation that resulted in President Washington sending in troops to quell what some feared could be a full-blown revolution. Opposition to the whiskey tax and the rebellion itself built support for the Republicans, who overtook the Federalist Party for power in 1802. The Whiskey Rebellion is considered one of the first major tests of the authority of the newly formed U.S. government. As stated, individual states incurred significant debt from the Revolutionary War. In 1790, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton pushed for the federal government to take over that debt. He also suggested an excise tax on whiskey to prevent further financial difficulty. President George Washington was opposed to Hamilton's suggestion of a whiskey tax, and in 1791, Washington journeyed through Virginia and Pennsylvania to speak with citizens about their views. Local government officials met the idea of a whiskey tax with enthusiasm, and Washington took this assurance back to Congress, which passed the bill. But protests against the new tax began immediately, and arguing that the tax was unfair to small producers. Under the new law, large producers paid the tax annually at a rate of 6 cents per gallon, and the more they produced, the further the tax breaks. However, small producers were stuck with paying 9 cents per gallon in taxes. Farmers took further issue because only cash would be accepted for tax payment. 9 cents a gallon, that seems like a lot.
Yep.
For back then.
Okay. So one of the things to point out, since you took a break, is that Washington gathered consensus. In other words, instead of just saying, I'm going to pass this, you know, there were two sides to Washington. One is, this constitutional, can we do this? And two, will the people like this? In other words, he may have been a hard general in battle. He was known for calling for the shooting down of his own men that abandoned their post. But he had a very genteel side to him, because when it came down to discipline in the military, it was absolutely expected. There was no tolerance, zero tolerance for your inability to be disciplined. Go ahead. Was that a question?
No.
Okay. No. So when it came to his slaves running away, he pleaded, he chased them down, he found them, and he pleaded, please, I'm not going to make you come home, but please come home, because if you get trapped, you're going to basically be, you know, thrown to who, you have no idea what your next master is going to do. You know, come right home. I mean, and he loved these men. As a matter of fact, men and women, and as they got sick, he tended to them. I mean, his his, even though they were slaves, he really took this full on responsibility, almost, you know, like you'd see a good church leader taking care of the flock or something like that. And so anyway, Washington was kind of a hard man to cast into this very particular mold. He had biases. Like I said earlier, he neglected to build the Navy, and he was slow to actually call forth the militia as we go through this. But bottom line, he didn't want to be viewed as a tyrant or a king that he was going, because he said so, this is what we're doing. He actually went out and got consensus, and as long as he could build consensus to pass a whiskey tax, then he was okay with it. You see, my point?
Right. Yep.
Okay. So let's keep going.
Okay. The law was immediately a failure, since refusals to pay the taxes were as common as intimidation against officials hired to collect them. Excise officers sent to collect the tax were met with defiance and threats of violence. Violence first broke out on September 11th, 1791. Excise officer Robert Johnson was riding through his collection route in western Pennsylvania when he was surrounded by 11 men dressed as women. The mob stripped him naked and then tarred and feathered him before stealing his horse and abandoning him in the forest. Johnson recognized two men in the mob. He made a complaint and warrants were issued for their arrest. A cattle drover named John Connor was sent with the warrants, and he suffered the same fate as Johnson. He was tied to a tree in the woods for 5 hours before being found. In response, Johnson resigned his post, fearing further violence. Incidents escalated over the next few years, and in 1793, the home of Pennsylvania excise officer Benjamin Wells was broken into twice. The first time, a mob of people forced their way in and assaulted Wells' wife and children. The second incident involved six men in disguises who attacked Wells while he was at home. The intruders demanded Wells' account books at gunpoint and insisted he resign his position. Feeling unrepresented in Congress, the citizens of western Pennsylvania gathered their own assembly with 3 to 5 representatives per county. While radical members pushed for open rebellion, moderates like Hugh Henry Breckinridge and future Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Albert Gallatin urged conciliatory measures. In the summer of 1794, Federal Marshal David Lennox began the process of serving writs to 60 distillers in western Pennsylvania who had not paid the tax. On July 14th, Lennox accepted the services of tax collector and wealthy land owner John Neville as guide through, I'm not sure how to say that county.
Allegheny
County.
Mm-hmm.
I'll pause there. Do you want
okay, yeah, so... Pause there? So now that you can see that this is really starting to pick up. And ironically, when was the first hostilities documented?
Okay, so the attack on John Neville's home, Bower Hill. On July 15th, they approached the home of William Miller, who refused to accept his summons. An argument ensued, and when Lennox and Neville rode off, they were face to face with an angry mob armed with pitchforks and muskets.
Oh, hold on here.
Okay.
If you go back up, violence first broke out on what day? Go up to the top where the whiskey tax, the second paragraph right there.
September 11th.
There you go. Interesting, huh?
Yeah, I thought that as I read it.
Okay. All right. I'm not sure if Osama bin Laden, you know, picked that day very specifically.
Yeah.
Who knows? But that was the first time under the Constitution that the unrest of the people got to a point where they started we lost civility and started attacking. Okay, go ahead. So the attack on Neville's home, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Someone had told the mob that federal agents were dragging people away. But Lennox and Neville were allowed to pass once that was understood to be untrue. Nonetheless, a shot was fired as two men rode away. On the morning of July 16th, Neville was asleep in his home, Bower Hill, when he was awakened by a crowd of angry men, some of whom had been served summons the previous day. The men claimed that Lennox needed to come with them because there was a threat to his life. Neville didn't believe the men and ordered them off his property. When the mob refused to move, Neville grabbed a gun and shot at the crowd, striking and killing Oliver Miller. In retaliation, the mob shot back at the house. Neville made it inside the house and sounded a signal horn, after which he heard the sound of his slaves attacking the crowd with firearms. Six members of the mob were wounded before they fled with Miller's body. By evening, the mob had reconvened for a meeting with a group of other people who declared revenge on Neville.
Okay, so now we actually have the first act of, you know, deadly force. You know, the tar and feathering and those types of things were really harassments, degradations, or, you know, hazings. But now deadly force, who killed who? Protesters killed, you know, a collector killed a protester. So who struck first?
The protesters.
Actually, the protesters struck, but they didn't use deadly force. The first person that died in the first person who died was Oliver Miller, who was a protester, where Neville just shot into the crowd, and he ended up striking him and killing him. So, you know, obviously tension is going to get, you know, worse and worse. Even though it may be a justifiable homicide because things escalated or what have you, it'd be one of those things. But still, you know, it comes down to the ultimate drawing blood. And what that does is it creates a succession of events that escalate. Okay, so, okay, keep going.
The destruction of Bower Hill. On July 17th, 1794, as many as 700 men marched to drums and gathered at Neville's home. They demanded his surrender. But Major James Kirkpatrick, one of the 10 soldiers who had come to the property to help defend it, answered that Neville was not there. In fact, Kirkpatrick had helped Neville escape the house and hide in a ravine. The mob demanded that the soldiers surrender. When that request was refused, they set fire to a barn and slave dwellings. The Neville women were allowed to flee to safety, after which the mob opened fire on the house following an hour of gunfighting. Following an hour of gunfighting, the mob's leader, James McFarlane, was killed. In a rage, the mob set fire to the other buildings, and the soldiers soon surrendered as the Bower Hill estate burned to the ground.
Okay, so now it just kicks up to the next level, right? And so one of the things that we'll realize is that even though slavery was on its way out, there were people that had slaves, and this is Western Pennsylvania, and you'll find that the slaves will actually took up arms to actually, you know, support these men. I should say the law keepers, those who were those who were trying to apply the tax. So go ahead, a threat to Pittsburgh.
Okay. Less than a week later, the mob met with local dignitaries who warned that Washington would send a militia to strike them down. They had to strike first. Wealthy landowner David Bradford, along with several other men, attacked a mail carrier and discovered three letters from Pittsburgh expressing disapproval of the attack on Neville's property. Bradford used these letters as an excuse to encourage an attack on Pittsburgh, inciting 7,000 men to show up at Braddock's Field east of the city. The city of Pittsburgh, fearing violence, sent a delegation to announce that the three-letter writers had been expelled from the city and to offer a gift of several barrels of whiskey. As the day ended, the crowd had drunk deeply from the barrels and weren't inspired to descend on Pittsburgh with any fury, instead gaining permission to march through Pittsburgh peacefully.
There you go. So doesn't it help to kind of, you know, soothe the wounds with, you know, imbibing them.
Yeah. Okay. Washington sends the militia with signs that the rebels were hoping to reignite the conflict and believing it was linked to unrest in other parts of the country. Hamilton wanted to send troops to Pennsylvania, but Washington opted for a peace envoy instead.
Mm-hmm.
Peace envoy failed. Washington met with his cabinet officials and presented evidence of the violence to the Supreme Court Justice James Wilson, who ruled a military response was justified under the auspices of the Militia Acts of 1792. Washington assumed emergency power to assemble more than 12,000 men from the surrounding states and eastern Pennsylvania as a federal militia.
Okay, so now we're kind of going to go through some bullets of points in fact of, you know, what happened and so forth. So it's kind of breaking away from the paradigm of storytelling, and we're just going to kind of lay out this is what happened, you know, based on the Constitution and so forth. So go ahead.
Okay. In Section 8 of the Constitution, the power to call forth the militia was expressly given to Congress. But only 2 years into George Washington's presidency, the Second Congress temporarily delegated its authority under the First Militia Clause by passing a statute to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. The Militia Act of 1792 was meant to be a 3-year-long experiment, but gave the president broader powers to call out the militia. Section 1 of the Act covered foreign invasions and imminent dangers from a foreign nation and met little resistance in Congress. On the other hand, Section 2, which dealt with suppressing insurrection, met with much resistance on the floor of Congress. After much debate, additional amendments were added requiring judicial intervention that the president must first order the insurgents to disperse. 2 years after this act passed, President Washington called forth the militia to suppress the Whiskey Rebellion.
Okay, so at this point, when we look at what was happening, Congress, you know, they're not in session all the time. And they didn't want to have to be called back to have to call forth the militia. So they said, well, let's create an act for a 3-year period that gives the president this broad authority to be able to form the militia. We're calling it forth. And based upon the president's execution, the militia will be brought forward. And so they put in place a 3-year call, leaving it to the president. Because, again, the president was not quick to use force. And so as they kind of discussed this, it was an insult to Washington, really, when people said, well, hold on here, before – you know, he's going to be able to do this, that they have to do, you know, these little, I'll just say, what was it? He had to call for the order, first order the insurgents to disperse. In other words, playing political correctness and tying his hands like we see big time today. Right?
Right.
Instead of actually just executing the law. And so there was already what I would say this compassionate political correctness play when the law is black and white. If you're having an insurrection, you need to call forth the militia. And so this was all kind of happening, and it had to happen, and we were so blessed that Washington was the president at that time.
By the way, we have 4 seconds left.
Okay, well, so thank you very much for letting me know. But the nation was really blessed, as I was going to say before we move into the next one. So obviously we're going into a promo, but we were really blessed to have Washington as the president at that time to be able to, you know, keep cooler heads and to try to pursue a civil way of resolving the problem. Because remember, he took consensus and everybody seemed to be in favor. So now he's what's going on? So anyway, we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so again, we're really lucky to have Washington because cooler heads prevailed, but eventually they did have to call forth the militia. So, and thank you for letting me know we were out of time, but let's move on. There's a few more bullets that we need to cover at this point.
So start with
in Washington's sixth state of the Union address, right?
Okay. In Washington's sixth state of the Union address, he recounted the actions that he took. First, Washington followed the Constitution and the Militia Act by first seeking and receiving certification from the Supreme Court. Upon testimony of these facts, an associate justice of the Supreme Court of the United States notified to me that in the counties of Washington, Allegheny, the Pennsylvania laws of the United States were opposed and the execution thereof obstructed by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshal of that district. Second, Washington issued a proclamation commanding the insurgents to disperse. I postponed, therefore, the summoning of the militia immediately into the field, but I required them to be held in readiness, that if my anxious endeavors to reclaim the deluded and to convince the malignant of their danger should be fruitless, military force might be prepared to act before the session should be too far advanced. The season should be too far advanced, sorry. My proclamation of the 7th of August last.
And that's the date.
1794.
Right. Okay.
Was accordingly issued and accompanied by the appointment of commissioners who were charged to repair to the scene of insurrection.
Right.
Finally, the president assembles the militia to quell the rebellion. Thus, the painful alternative could not be discarded. I ordered the militia to march after once more admonishing the insurgents in my proclamation of the 25th of September last. Washington was distraught that militia force had to be used against his own countrymen. He was very happy to report that the rebellion was over. The event itself was disgraceful and required a significant portion of the country's resources, but it proved that our prosperity rested on a solid foundation of citizens who understood the true principles of liberty.
So let's stop right there. What it required for government to behave and for people to behave is for we the people to do our job. We have a self-government. And the only thing that keeps us from having a self-government is you. If you're not actively involved, you're not teaching, you're not educating to avoid pitfalls and problems, because obviously there's nobody doing it, or there's not enough people, I should say, doing it, that are actually listening to what has to happen, what has to be done. Because when we look today at the fact that we're literally being killed, that our government is doing things that are antithetical to the purpose that we created this government, and they're doing all the bidding for the globalists and so forth, why is that happening? It's not happening because we're, you know, we want that to happen. It's happening because we are allowing it to happen.
it required the citizens to tell other citizens to behave. It requires citizens to tell their public servants to behave. If we, as self-governing people, refuse to govern, then we get the government we deserve. So, carry on. Let's keep going.
All right. While there is cause to lament that occurrences of this nature should have disgraced the name or interrupted the tranquility of any part of our community, or should have diverted to a new application any portion of the public resources, there are not wanting real and substantial consolations for the misfortune. It is demonstrated that our prosperity rests on solid foundations by furnishing an additional that my fellow citizens understand the true principles of government and liberty, that they feel their inseparable union, that notwithstanding all the devices which have been used to sway them from their interests and duty, they are not as ready to maintain the authority of the laws against licentious invasions as they were to defend their rights against usurpation.
Okay. So Commander-in-Chief George Washington could not have been prouder of the militiamen that he called forth and marched 300 miles into Pennsylvania, right? And then the final bullets here, go ahead.
It has been a spectacle displaying to the highest advantage of Republican government to behold the most and the least wealthy of our citizens standing in the same ranks as private soldiers, preeminently distinguished by being the army of the Constitution, undeterred by a march of 300 miles over rugged mountains, by approach of an inclement season, or by any other discouragement. Washington was also proud and wanted to thank the patriotic support he received from the governors. Which is, and then he says, nor ought I to omit to acknowledge the efficacious and patriotic cooperation which I have experienced from the chief magistrates of the states to which my requisitions have been addressed.
Right.
Unquote. So above all, he wanted to give praise to every citizen of America for their affection and vigilant support of the Constitution. And then, quote, he says, to every description of citizens, let praise be given, but let them persevere in their affectionate vigilance over that precious depository of American happiness, the Constitution of the United States. Let them cherish it to forsake of those who, from every clime, are daily seeking a dwelling in our land. Unquote. And when all was said and done, he hoped they would realize that this instruction was based upon ignorance and false accusations of their government.
Okay.
And when the calm moments of reflection, they shall have retraced the origin and progress of the insurrection, let them determine whether it has not been fermented by combinations of men who, careless of consequences and disregarding the unerring truth that those who rouse cannot always appease a civil convulsion, have disseminated from an ignorance or perversion of facts, suspicions, jealousies, and accusations of the whole government.
So what does that mean by combinations of men? Isn't that basically by the conspiring or the conspiracies of men?
Oh, yeah, that's what it would be.
Right. Okay. Language was a little bit different back then, but anyway. Okay, so now is the time. Go ahead.
Now it was time for Congress to amend the laws and make the Militia Act of 1792 permanent. What better and more honorable way was there for Congress to thank the citizens of America than to give the president full and lasting power to call forth the militia to suppress insurrections and repeal invasions.
Okay, so let's stop right there before you read this, the quotation from him. What this required was to literally amend the Constitution so that Congress would no longer have the power to call forth the militia, for them to basically place this onto the president, which would have actually been an egregious violation against the design of the Constitution, because the president, having full authority and capability of executing his own laws or his own will, if he could just call forth a militia without Congress being in the middle, then we actually have set ourselves up, because that's exactly what Lincoln did. Lincoln went down the path of just, I'm going to war. Congress be damned. I'm going to war. And that's why he basically shut down the government. I mean, Lincoln did so many violations against the Constitution. My head spins thinking about it, how this guy just trampled all over the Constitution. And unfortunately, the Republican Party nationwide revels in that man, and they have no idea who really created the Republican Party. But I'm not sure if you caught it earlier, but basically, if you read, I believe, right in the very first line, it talked about the Republican Party. Opposition for the whiskey tax and the rebellion itself built support for the Republicans. Mm-hmm. So actually, just to move the curtain a little bit, once we're done with this, we're going to actually dive into the founding of the Republican Party of 1792. See, all of these things were kind of happening simultaneously. And so I think it's imperative, because I've never done it before. So we're going to go through and read, the actual definition, or I should say, the true historical account of the Republican Party. Because most people have completely mislabeled it as the Democratic Republicans. That is incorrect. And so anyway, keep going.
Having thus fulfilled the engagement which I took when I entered into office, to the best of my ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, on you, gentlemen, and the people by whom you are deputed, I rely for support. In the arrangement to which the possibility of a similar contingency will naturally draw your attention, it ought not to be forgotten that the militia laws have been exhibited such striking defects as could not have been supplied by the zeal of our citizens. Besides the extraordinary expense and waste, which are not the least of the defects, every appeal to those laws is attended without a doubt on its success. The devising and establishing of a well-regulated militia would be a genuine source of legislative honor and a perfect title to public gratitude. I therefore entertain a hope that the present session will not pass without carrying to its full energy the power of organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and thus providing, in the language of the Constitution, for calling them forth to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
Okay, so what he's looking for is substantial changes, but that would really require an amendment. Because at this point in time, the way the language is there, I mean, the language is already there, that they're supposed to provide for the training, the uniform standards, all of those things are there. They never amended the Constitution. What they did was they created acts, and they started assuming more and more control over the militia, which is why the militia is non-existent today. People say that the militia is the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard. No. The militia is a structure that is not to be permanently held. In other words, when you have an army, the U.S. Army, when the U.S. Army is uniformed and we're spending money on it, that is an established army. The Constitution was clear that we weren't to have standing armies, that our national defense was rested upon the Navy and the Marine Corps to protect ourselves from external threats.
So they didn't even amend the Constitution. They just made acts.
Correct. Oh yeah, that's what they've been doing.
Yeah.
That's all they do is they create, like the Civil Rights Act. Instead of actually amending the Constitution so that it becomes a legitimate law, They just say, we're making this law and we're inflicting it upon you. Because they've gotten so arrogant in what they do. That the child believes it's superior to the parents.
So and we're in the founders of our Constitution didn't follow the Constitution?
So you got to remember, Madison was arguing constantly in office with these people that wanted to go and take latitude well beyond what the Constitution allowed. That's why he was constantly debating everybody, saying, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ended up happening, this is why we cover this curriculum, because it was struggle, 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 struggle until all, oh no, I can't believe you did that. The 1798 Sedition Acts and, you know, the Alien Sedition Acts. Because in 1798, that's when Madison and Jefferson said, oh, we can't believe you did that. And so they go off down this path of trying to get the states to actually do what they're supposed to do. And they Republic Review, they failed to do it. And so they execute in less than a year's time. They rally their party, which hadn't been completely, you know, obsolete or just languishing out there. It had been basically growing and growing. They exercised their party in that 1 year's time because it all started in 1800 when they said, okay, we're going to have to challenge Adams and take the presidency. And that's exactly what they did. And there's a lot behind all of that. And I could see the divine hand of providence intervening in America's behalf to help us get back on track. And that's when the Republicans dominated the political positions all the way into Quincy Adams. Now, deservingly so through Jefferson and Madison, Monroe somewhat deserving so, but I mean, Monroe made very egregious errors. And then John Quincy Adams, the same. But I mean, they were still decent men compared to what we have today. Anyway. So, okay, so let's go ahead and, you know, finish this up with, you know, the last few paragraphs and so forth.
Okay. So in 1795, the Third Congress replaced the original statute with the 1795 Militia Act, which removed or reduced several of the major checks on the president's authority to call forth the militia in times of insurrection. Among other things, the new act removed the requirement of getting an antecedent court order and removed the requirement to proclaim a dispersal before the militia is called out. Clearly, our founders envisioned that Congress owned the power to call out the militia, but in 1795, they permanently deleted that power to the president and authorized the president to act decisively, expeditiously, and unilaterally in times of military emergencies. Washington met first with the rebels, who assured him the militia was not needed and that order had been restored. Washington opted to retain the military option until proof of submission was apparent. The large and well-armed militia marched into western Pennsylvania and was met with angry citizens, but little violence. When a rebel army didn't appear, the militia rounded up suspected rebels instead. However, the rebellion's instigators had already fled, and the militia's prisoners weren't involved in the rebellion. They were marched to Philadelphia to stand trial regardless. Only two men were found guilty of treason, and both were pardoned by Washington. Next is the trial of treason. The Whiskey Rebellion was important.
Yep.
The federal response to the Whiskey Rebellion was widely believed to be a critical test of federal authority, one that Washington's fledging government met with success. The whiskey tax that inspired the rebellion remained in effect until 1802. Under the leadership of President Thomas Jefferson and the Republican Party, which, like many citizens, opposed Hamilton's Federalist tax policies, the tax was repealed after continuing to be almost impossible to collect.
There you go. So it became a passive resistance against it. People would just avoid, and they spent their wheels for the longest time. And because, again, this was a necessity. It's like today trying to tax milk, baby formula, you know, or taxing things that, you know, grandma and grandpa need, you know, that's very unique to their care or what have you. That's grandpa stuff or grandma, grandpa's. I mean, you're basically attacking the most vulnerable in our society, or at least that's the perception when you start going after what we would consider necessities, either for a very vulnerable part of our society, for all of society. It doesn't matter. The real tone literally changed to where the majority of the money that the federal government was going to get was on imposts. But they started realizing that they could play shenanigans with the union's properties, i.e. the territories, and start actually selling property, which they didn't have the authority to do. So when we start looking at some of the territories and so forth, when they sold and practically gave away land, they didn't have the authority to do that. They had the authority to create laws and regulations, but they were the stewards of that land for the incoming states. And so when those states joined the union, any land that the federal government granted to the railroad, any land that the federal government granted to anybody that was in that state, whether they even created a treaty for an Indian reservation, they did not have the authority to do that. When that state became a self-sovereign state and basically self-proclaimed, you know, what they were going to be, that was all the land for those people of that state, not the state itself as an entity or business of wealth. In other words, you know, the state does not possess and control it. It is the steward for the people. Now, there's lots of land in a state that people don't necessarily own. So the state has to maintain that, and the state has to, you know, come up with ways of using it, like letting loggers log, you know, and tend to, so that they can, you know, mitigate risks in ensuring that, you know, they've got they've got good condition so that the forest don't burn down, roadways, what have you. But the problem is that the state and the people had the state do things with good intent, but they never amended their constitutions to do it. And because we failed to do that all along the way, what we ended up doing, because, you know, we amended it when it was a benefit for somebody, but not everybody, there would be, you know, an amendment, like the amendment for abortion. Right. There have been some states that actually amended their constitution. The state of Washington in 1971, they amended their constitution to legalize abortion. And so they did that, but they never had an amendment to their constitution regarding the consumption and use of and the control of energy in the state.
Right.
But they have all sorts of regulations, and they're actually making laws now regarding and regulating energy. Just like the environment. Oh, well, we want to protect the environment. We're creating all these, but they were never delegated that authority. So it's all these good intentions that they'll assume powers when it's good intentions, but when it's really bad, they'll force it down your throat with an amendment. But because nobody challenges government when it's perceived to be doing a good thing. And then over time, when it transitions from a good thing to a tyrannical thing, like the Environmental Protection Agency, or energy, commerce, or housing, labor, I mean, any of these departments out there that the federal government's created and inflicted upon the states, all unconstitutional, by the way. I mean, no state, very few states, I think California is one of them, but very few states actually have true labor laws delegated, or I should say, the ability in their constitution for them to regulate labor. That doesn't exist in most state constitutions. So how is it that your state is regulating your labor?
Yeah, and making a minimum wage.
Or establishing the minimum wage. Correct. The federal government came along and said, you need to do this. You need to establish this minimum wage. And they gave them money to create the office and so forth. And that was a roundabout way to actually backdoor the states in regulating and controlling us. It's all unconstitutional. So what do you do? I mean, what do you do when, you know, they're doing all of these different things?
Yeah, it seems pretty hopeless since they started doing it from the very beginning.
They have, which is why it is so important that we create petitions so that we highlight the entire history of how that was never delegated and how over the history of time it was gradually assumed for, you know, whatever the good reasons were. Oh, well, it was for the children. Oh, we're trying to protect the children. We want to save the children's lives and because they're children. And, you know, they're pulling on the heartstrings of America. Who's going to stand up and say, the heck with the children? Right? I mean, who's going to say that?
Yeah.
And so they get away with this. And then, you know what? We're not only doing this good stuff for the children, but we can do this for old people, too. You know, those who can't work anymore, the retirees, and those who have disabilities. And, you know, it's all about protecting, you know, the less able. It becomes a disease. This goes...
Yeah, we're going to force you to get vaccinated and do this and do that because it's for the good of the people. And if you don't want to, then you don't like the people.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, how people create those leaps of faith or those, you know, just connecting the dots. Oh, because of this, this, and this, you know, you're a bad person. So anyway, the way out of this is we have to write these petitions. And so getting people smart, because, folks, there's a lot of petitions to be written. And all you need to do is need to just learn how to write a good, thorough petition. You want to be as inclusive as possible, include all the laws, and lay it out that these powers have never been delegated. Understanding, you know, just you can talk about a problem. It's the elephant in the room. But until you're ready to actualize the problem and get rid of it, it's just talk. It's just ranting. Oh, you know, we got together on Friday. We you know, had a few drinks and we, you know, got pretty pissed and we ranted and ranted. And, you know, I feel pretty good now because I, you know, in my little vacuum chamber, you know, with my friends, like-minded people, we all agreed how bad it was. And so I feel better now.
Yeah.
That is not self-government. 4 seconds left. Anything more to add?
I do not. No.
Okay. All right. Well, folks, when we come back tomorrow, we're going to be going into the Republican Party, the establishment of the Republican Party. I know sequentially it actually had formed before the Whiskey Rebellion, but we want to give you how Congress has acknowledged this Republican Party and actually talked about it. And we're going to give you Madison's view as well. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.